approve of me, or they just won't accept me as I am, start racing through your mind. In response, you feel hurt, and before you know it, you're spooning ice cream into your mouth right out of the carton. You probably didn't know what you were thinking when you got criticized, but the next thing you knew, you were binging on ice cream. Your behavior is sometimes controlled by an internal negative attitude that you aren't even aware of because it is so overlearned as to be automatic. The question arises, if that's the case, what can I do about it? The good news is that these thoughts, like your real-time self-talk, can be controlled, challenged, and changed. By changing the way you think, you can change the way you feel and act. What you're about to do in the following series of steps will help you change your emotional state so that you no longer medicate yourself with food in emotionally charged situations. Step 1. Take ownership of your reactions. In truth, no event, no person can stress you out or make you eat a box of donuts. What initiates stress and anxiety is your response to what happens in the world. Suppose, for example, that you apply for a job that you really wanted, but you're not hired. That is an external event to which you had some internal reaction. It is your internal reaction to not being hired that impacts your emotions, not the event of not being hired. Let's say your internal reaction is, hey, I don't like getting turned down, but I know in my heart I'm talented, capable, and competent, and I'll just apply for another job. Here, you're being rational, realistic, yet you are not likely to get upset and suffer a huge blow to your self-worth. On the other hand, maybe your internal reaction is, I'm such a loser. I blew the interview. It was so humiliating, and I got what I deserved. That job was too good for me, and I'm really not good enough to even apply for it. They knew I couldn't cut it. Give me a bag of chips. I want to feel better. Whatever the situation, you can choose your reaction no matter what the circumstances. Your interpretation of those events is of your own choosing. The events in your daily life have only the meaning you assign to them. This is why one of my life laws states, there is no reality, only perception. How you interpret the events, circumstances, and situations in your life is entirely up to you. If your response is counterproductive, test your perceptions more often and become more accountable for how you react to the stress and problems in your life. Stop being overly sensitive to the negatives while filtering out the positives. Maintain an active, ongoing awareness of your reactions and recognize where your outlook is distorted so you can make important adjustments. Make no mistake, I'm not suggesting that one of your choices is to interpret everything that happens to you in life in some Pollyanna fashion. Should you experience one of life's top stressors, say the death of a child or a divorce, it would not be rational for you to interpret that in any way as being good. However, you do have a choice about whether that event will be your absolute undoing or whether it becomes something you deal with in a constructive manner. Doing so means that you will create meaning and purpose out of your suffering, and that can take any number of forms, from becoming a counselor to other victims of similar tragedy, to volunteering for some other cause. The most important choice you have in light of a personal tragedy is what you do now. So in short, you must own your choices and your reactions. Step 2. Resolve rather than react to life's problems. Take a problem-solving approach to emotion-provoking events. Commit to resolving rather than enduring the problems that are contributing to your stress, anxiety, or depression. You can either sit around and stew about the situation or you can make the choice to be self-directed, take action, and adopt a solution side approach to your life. If it's a bill you can't pay, whining and worrying about it won't satisfy your creditor, and neither will eating yourself into oblivion. If it's an argument with your spouse, withdrawing, pouting, and barricading yourself behind a locked bedroom door with a sack of cookies won't bring things to resolution. What's more, none of these situations will get better if you respond by stuffing yourself with uncontrolled amounts of food. Food is not a fix-all. Ask yourself, do I just react to what's in my face, or do I act? Stop living reactively and begin to choose the right attitude and the right behavior to generate the right results. Remember that it's action, not reaction, that gets meaningful, constructive results. So take charge, because problems almost never resolve themselves. They don't get better with inattention. When you're accountable for your problems and for their solutions, you are an agent of change. Step 3. Decelerate your thinking. Changing your emotional response and the unwanted eating behavior that flows from it requires slowing down, listening carefully to your thinking, evaluating your reactions, and altering those reactions. That is why you must learn to decelerate your thinking. Put your mind in slow-mo like a videotape or film, so that you can cause everything to go into a steady, deliberate pace. I know this sounds like a tall order, but let me assure you that it will be one of the easiest and most effective ways to manage your emotional life and therefore start taking control of your eating behavior. The way you do this deceleration is to become very still and very quiet and start recording your thoughts. These high-speed thoughts and internal reactions always precede your feelings and emotions. Trust me, you did tell yourself something if you now feel angry, mad, anxious, frustrated, sad, or depressed. From now on, whenever you get upset, slow down and listen ever so carefully to what you're telling yourself. Be sure to write your thoughts down on paper. If all you do is just think them through, there will be no impact. Writing them down helps you appraise your thoughts more objectively and allows you to get some distance from them. Think of what you write down as being kind of a mirror. Just as it would be impossible to study your own face without a mirror, it is impossible to really objectively study your own life without writing it down. So, write it down. Step 4. Challenge and restructure your automatic thoughts. If you now get it that emotional pain stems from your thoughts, then you must correct errors in your thinking. By overriding your mental conditioning, you can reprogram yourself and can thus better manage your emotional life. With the first key, right thinking, you began this critically important process by asking yourself 4 questions regarding your internal dialogue. And you must do the same in disputing your automatic thoughts. Are they true? Do they serve your best interests? Do they advance and protect your health? Do they help you achieve your weight management goals? Once again, answer these hard questions about how you think and what you believe about yourself. When you start to test them against reality, your beliefs and attitudes will begin to change in rather short measure, no matter how long-standing they are. Until you stop and analyze your internal reactions, you will go on believing them and continuing to deal with these emotions that are so much at war with your best self. So the paramount issue for you is that you have to understand how you work from the inside out, and what makes you feel the way you feel. To be liberated from the control of negative emotions, you'll need to do a fair amount of this kind of introspection. You have to see the truth in the fact that you are responsible for upsetting yourself. You can't change other people or other conditions. You can only change your reactions to them. That's why you'll have to identify the irrational thoughts and beliefs that you continually and automatically send yourself. And you will have to sort through these messages, restructure them, and replace them with authentic responses that correct your high-speed thinking. Only by counteracting your self-criticisms can you better control the emotions that are keeping your unwanted eating behavior alive. You must get in touch with your thoughts and feelings and why you're having them. Have the courage to ask yourself the hard questions and to give the answers an appropriate voice. Get real with yourself. When conflict arises or when you're walking through an emotional minefield, as you know you will, don't panic and seek solace in food. Have an emotional plan in place for how you will deal with and respond to the situation. You will simply say to yourself, I will control what attitude I take towards this situation. I have the power to choose my perceptions and my reactions, and I will exercise this power of choice in every circumstance, every day of my life. Step 5. Gain emotional closure. If you allow ugly emotions to take root in your heart and mind, they will not remain specific to the situation that provoked them. These emotions begin to contaminate all of your relationships and all of your interactions with other people. Who you once were dies away, and now you are defined by these ugly emotions. What ultimately makes these emotions so powerful is that they change who you are. They change what you do and contaminate what you give. It's just so easy in a busy and ever-changing life to allow emotional pain and discord to accumulate. But heaps of unfinished emotional business can crush your self-control, and you will self-medicate again and again with ever-increasing amounts of food. If emotional pain or problems have cropped up in your life, you must insist on getting closure. Closure means you don't carry the problem or the pain. You address the issue, then you slam shut the book and put it away. Whatever that takes, do it. Whatever it requires, you do it to get past it. You must avoid piling up this kind of burden in your life. You must give yourself emotional closure. The emotions I'm describing here are the open wounds of unfinished emotional business with somebody somewhere. A person or persons who is the target of all that negative emotion. If you wear the unhealed scars of hatred, anger, resentment, and bitterness, you are doing so because you have never gotten emotional closure on the treatment you got at the hands of that other person. You and only you choose how you feel. If you choose to carry the hatred, then know that you choose to experience the world in a dark way, and you're all the more likely to medicate yourself with food. The goal of this step is to help you gain important emotional closure so that you can resolve your situation and its associated pain and prevent potential relapses into behavior that keeps you from attaining your weight management goals. A powerful process that I use to help people get emotional closure is what I call your minimal effective response, your MER. The operative word here is minimal, meaning the least thing you can do to get emotional closure. So that you fully understand this concept, let me explain what MER is not. For one thing, it's not seeking revenge or plotting ways to undermine other people. Taking such actions only harms you in the long run because you are still holding on to self-destructive emotions. MER seeks to satisfy your need for emotional resolution without creating a whole new set of problems. Maybe it means confronting yourself or the other person. Maybe it means taking legal action. Maybe it requires forgiveness or making an apology. Maybe it means writing a letter to someone or stomping on a wrongdoer's grave. Maybe it involves seeing a mental health counselor, talking to your pastor or minister, or turning the situation and its emotional battle over to God. There are many different ways to obtain your MER. The key is to get maximum results for minimum expense. When you initiate your MER, trust me, it will lessen your need to use food as medication. To map out how you will execute your MER, you can use the following questions. What action can you take to resolve your emotional pain? If you were successful and achieved this resolution, how would you feel? Does the feeling you will have match the feeling you want to have? Remembering the word minimal, could there be some other economical action that would give you the emotional resolve you need? After considering your own emotional responses and the nature and degree of the suffering you have endured, what is your MER? Maybe you don't have the energy or resources to take legal action. Maybe all you need to do is compose a letter and write down all your thoughts and feelings. Maybe that MER will work for you. Maybe you need to mail the letter if your situation involves another person, but whatever your MER is, you need to identify it, and you need to do it. You need to say, okay, it's done. I've had enough. I will no longer allow you to rob me of my self-control. I'm shutting the book on this. My emotional business is finished, and I'm free to go back to being that person that I know that I am. There is one more facet to this vitally important action called MER. The key with which you unlock your emotional prison and set yourself free may be a minimally effective response called forgiveness. Initially, forgiveness may be very hard for you because you probably feel that it demonstrates weakness rather than strength. I submit to you that this powerful human act does anything but, and it may be absolutely essential in order for you to gain emotional closure and make positive change. Let's be clear by what I mean when I use the word forgiveness. I'm talking about something that happens entirely within you. You see, forgiveness is a choice that you make to release yourself from the emotional prison of anger, hatred, and resentment. I'm not saying that the choice is an easy one, only that it is a necessary one. You should also know that when I use the word forgiveness, I in no way mean that I am asking you to take the position that whatever may have happened to you in your life is now okay. Forgiveness is not a feeling that you passively wait to come over you. It is an active choice that you make. Another one of my life laws states that there is power in forgiveness. And the reason is that without forgiveness, you are destined to lug around your emotional burdens and suffer the emotional and physical consequences as a result. You may believe right now that you are justified to hate or harbor rage against someone who has hurt you deeply enough to create these emotions. You may believe that they deserve it and are made to suffer by your hatred of them. But to carry around these beliefs is to pay an unbelievably high price, because those feelings can become so pervasive, so powerful as to contaminate every element of your current life. When Leonardo da Vinci was working on his masterpiece, The Last Supper, he became angry with a certain man. As his temper flared, he spewed out bitter words to the poor man. Afterwards, da Vinci returned to his painting and tried to work on the face of Jesus, but was so consumed by his anger that he could not compose himself for the meticulous work that was required. Finally, he laid aside his painting tools, sought out the man, and asked for forgiveness. The man accepted his apology, and da Vinci was able to finish painting the face of Jesus. Do you see the damage that an unforgiving spirit can inflict? That anger, hatred, and resentment becomes so all-consuming, so much so that it becomes a part of your every waking hour. By not forgiving your wrongdoers, you allow them to lock you in a prison, and they win. Forgiveness of those who transgressed against you or those you love is not about them. It's about you. If you are unsure how to forgive, if you are unsure about what to say within your heart, let me help you give a voice to your choice of forgiveness. You might say the following to yourself. I am making a choice to forgive you. By doing so, I free myself from the bond I had with you through hatred, anger, resentment, or fear. I take back my power and gain the freedom that only forgiveness can bring. You cannot hurt me and you cannot control me. I forgive for myself. Trust me on this. The only escape from your particular emotional prison may truly be through forgiveness. By making that choice, you rise above the pain to take the moral high ground and forgive the person who hurt you. If you allow people who have wronged you to keep you in prison, then they win. Don't worry about when or how they'll get theirs. Their judgment will not come from you, but ultimately from a higher power who settles all accounts. Rethink the meaning of forgiveness and set yourself free from an emotional pain that has been inflicted on you by others in your life. Don't wait another day. You have the ability to forgive these people, not as a gift to them, but as a gift to yourself. Forgive them, start healing, and let's get on with your life. Before leaving this key, let me talk to you about a coping tool that, if built into the day-to-day flow of your life, will begin to restore peace and tranquility and keep you from turning to food for solace from emotional pain. If you're upset and treat yourself to a plate of cookies or a bag of candy because you deserve it, get real. There are other ways to treat yourself and restore calm without resorting to a food binge. That's why you must carve out time in your life for tension-reducing activities. I suspect that if you habitually overeat in reaction to stress or to emotional pain, then you have no clue as to how to relax without a food binge. You are more accustomed to putting something fattening in your mouth to get relief rather than using non-food activities to calm yourself down. When your nerve cells become agitated by anxiety or depression and your mental response to this emotional state, it is not easy to quiet them down. Sure, you can do it quickly by resorting to chemical means such as tranquilizers or alcohol or high-caloric comfort foods, but those are devastatingly counterproductive and will cause you to close the door to other positive alternatives that can be incredibly powerful. These alternatives include, but are not limited to, exercising, which is a powerful stress reliever, performing relaxation exercises, and listening to music. By most research accounts, these activities work directly on your nervous system by releasing endorphins, your brain's natural tranquilizers, to produce a state of reduced anxiety and a feeling of calm. These activities are natural, non-chemical, and inexpensive relaxants. When you consider various tension-reducing activities, I realize that you may not be open to relaxation exercises such as deep breathing, yoga, or meditation. Maybe you think they won't help or that they won't work. But what if something like this is exactly what you need when anxiety, stress, or depression strikes? What if it is? When you are tense and under stress, there are corresponding and instantaneous responses in your physical body. One is a tightening of your stomach muscles and your diaphragm, a large sheet-like muscle located at the bottom of your chest cavity that is used for breathing. You begin to breathe in a shallow manner, and this creates even more tension. But by deep breathing, which is a type of relaxation exercise, you can release this tension and become more mentally focused on resolving the stress. Now, don't lock up on me here. This isn't Eastern or mystical stuff. It's a quick, practical way to relax, and you can do it anywhere, at your desk, in an airplane, in your car, before you give a speech or make an important sales call, wherever. And you can do it without anyone knowing about it. All it involves is taking fuller and deeper breaths, inhaling and exhaling through your nose very slowly, and letting your chest rise and fall in a steady rhythm. In less than a minute, your diaphragm loosens. Your brain senses this, interprets it, and begins to release endorphins that further reduce the tension level in your body. Pretty soon, your tension is gone. You've pushed out all that is possible, and you're in the realm of relaxation. On the text files CD, you will find instructions and a script on how to go about achieving stress reduction in this manner. To help you see the power in these techniques, let me introduce you to my sister-in-law, Cindy, who, as a single mom, raised three successful daughters and worked three jobs to send them all through college. She gave me permission to tell her story, and I offer it as an example of how being open-minded to new and different techniques of coping can be life-changing in their effect. Cindy's story began one morning in June of 2001. Just before sunrise, Cindy was being driven by her friend Jim to an airport in Oklahoma City, 2 hours away from her small-town home. She had won a trip from her employer based on her excellent sales performance and was on her way to enjoy a much-needed vacation. As they traveled, the country roads were empty, the morning was still. Then struck the horror. From an overpass, some madman or madmen dumped a vat of acid on the passenger side windshield. It crashed through the windshield, dousing Cindy on virtually every side with a tortuous liquid fire. After swiftly eating away her clothing, the acid next ate at her flesh, melting and peeling away her skin to burn more than 70% of her body, including her face, eyes, scalp, mouth, her entire torso, and the front of her legs. Miles from anywhere and without water, Jim drove at lightning speed to find help, while the acid continued its relentless assault on Cindy's flesh and left her screaming in agony. Jim pulled into an open gas station and called 911. Heroically, he began splashing water over Cindy, trying desperately to wash the burning acid from her face, eyes, and body, awaiting the arrival of an ambulance. Nothing could have prepared Cindy for what she was now to face in the months that followed this act of cruel, senseless violence. So began more than a dozen brutal reconstructive surgeries, including skin grafts and the replacement of her eyelids and chin. Twice a day, her burns had to be cleaned so that the infection would not grow and her body could heal itself. It was a trial no human should have to go through. The physical pain was excruciating. It was hellish. Even more unspeakable was the destruction of her life, the end of her world as she knew it. At first, some modicum of relief came in the form of painkillers, but these could exact their own hell. Fearing addiction to painkillers, Cindy turned to me for help. I enlisted the aid of my mentor, G. Frank Lawless, Ph.D., who is one of the leading authorities in body-mind control in the world today. He designed a three-part program for Cindy that involves special relaxation and deep breathing exercises to help her overcome her fears and begin the healing process. Self-calming techniques that helped her control her pain and deal with the emotional scars of the tragedy, and visual imagery so that she could see her skin accepting the grafts and becoming as new as an infant's skin. Cindy had little confidence in these methods initially, but her attitude would soon change and change dramatically. Cindy recently told me that if it had not been for Dr. Lawless's help, she never would have made it, that she would have given up living. Further, the program he designed for her dramatically accelerated her healing to the utter amazement of her physicians. Cindy confessed that her own judgmental nature had almost cheated her out of this absolutely life-saving intervention. For a very dear and beloved woman, this trip of terror turned into a life of triumph. Had she chosen to let this person who committed this horrible act continue to haunt her, she would have engulfed herself in bitterness only to empower the perpetrator to hurt her a second time around. But she did not. Every day that she awakens, Cindy feels blessed for the incredible day she has with her daughters and grandchildren, and thankful to God for every new day of living. There is certainly more to her story, especially about how Cindy came back to life physically, emotionally, and spiritually, but I will leave it at this. My message to you right now is simple. Guard against being closed-minded. Do not slam your ears shut. Your challenge is to consider all the possible coping skills available to you other than eating, the possibilities that can bring you the payoffs of peace and balance in your life. Be willing to plunge into the unknown if necessary, leaving behind the safe, unchallenging, and familiar existence. Reach. Reach in order to have more. As you incorporate more tension-reducing activities in your life, please continue to work hard on your underlying reactions and responses to stress and emotional pain, and change them so that you become less reactive. This will help you manage your emotions in the long run. There is no doubt about it. Even so, something as simple as breathing deeply will help you calm down so that you can at least examine and evaluate your reaction to the pain or stress so that your thinking can stay focused and you will avoid medicating yourself with food. Learning to better manage your emotions often greatly reduces not only the frequency and intensity of those emotions, but also the number of times you slide back into the old self-destructive patterns of overeating, binging, and other actions that run crosswise to weight management. You'll be astounded by how much more orderly, peaceful, and fulfilling your life will become. You'll push your emotional life to the best levels of who you are in your mind and heart. You'll have a newfound sense of freedom. You'll feel good about yourself and your body. You'll feel good about life, and you will live it to the fullest and best of your ability. Key 3, a no-fail environment. Unlock the door to external control. You can't eat what's not there. When you reduce your exposure to food, you program yourself against out-of-control eating and make it impossible to fail at weight loss. This key unlocks the door to external control. External control means that your environment, places like your home or office, anywhere you see food, think about food, store food, prepare food, sneak food, and eat food, is safe from problematic foods and reminders to eat. With external control, food is out of sight, out of reach, and out of mind. Recently, I received letters from two women who took to heart my message that you can't eat unhealthy food if it's not there. They decided to clean out their cupboards and refrigerators, plus avoid fast food restaurants and other places that did not support their weight loss goals. With these very simple changes in their lifestyle, both women lost 10 and 14 pounds respectively in less than 3 weeks. Just as they did, you will find that weight loss becomes so much easier when you control your environment by eliminating opportunities that invite snacking, overeating, and binging. This key has nothing to do with increasing willpower or trying to mentally resist food temptations. It's about re-engineering your environment, in such a way that it pulls for the result that you desire. Let's begin this process by auditing your environment and your level of exposure to food and to reminders of food. What I want you to do is take a critical and probing inventory of the food in your home, office, car, and anywhere else you stash food, encounter food, or are exposed to reminders of food in order to see exactly how problematic your world is. Get your pen and paper ready. I'm going to ask you about 20 questions. In answering each of these questions, write down either 1 for yes or 0 for no. Unless you are 100% honest in your inventory, you're doing yourself no good. So be real here. Remember, 1 for yes, 0 for no. Ready? Do you keep lots of junk food in your house? Do you store food in your house in plain sight? Do you have candy-filled dishes or bowls of nuts in your house? Do you store food in rooms of your house other than your kitchen? Does your desk drawer look like a convenience store? Do you keep food stashed in your glove compartment or purse? Do you routinely prepare family-style meals served on large platters? Do you choose restaurants with buffets or family-size meals? Do you have numerous diet books in your house? Do you eat by the clock? Does your daily route take you past vending machines, restaurants, bakeries, or other eateries? Do you shop without a grocery list? Does the presence of specific people trigger you to eat? Do you prepare snacks for your kids or spouse? Are you the only one who cleans up the kitchen after a meal? Do you keep fattening foods easily accessible? Do you buy fattening foods in large packages? Do you buy extra-large bags of easy-to-eat processed foods such as chips, candy, or cookies? Are you reluctant to throw out fattening leftovers? Do you fail to pre-plan what you will eat prior to going to a restaurant? Now, put the program on pause and add up your total. Realistically, any score higher than 2 indicates that your environment is a standing invitation to eat. If your total score is 10 or higher, your environment is riddled with problems. Food is everywhere you turn, your house, your car, your office. It's tough to exercise control when food and reminders of food are so prevalent in your life. Yours is a temptation-rich environment, for sure. But remember, it is the environment over which you have the most control. For this key to fit the lock, in other words, get you through the door of external control, I must first talk to you about the cues operating in your environment and how they're standing in your way of positive change. In theatrical terms, a cue is a signal to a performer to recite a line or begin a certain action. Similarly, eating cues, which are basically reminders of food, trigger your decision to eat. If you prefer the shrink term for cues, they are stimuli that elicit your response, and that response is to eat. Most overweight people are more vulnerable to cues than their thin counterparts, and much research bears this out. Eating cues can be either external or internal. Some internal cues are physical, that is, they're signs of true biological hunger brought on by specific responses that go on inside your body because it is demanding nourishment. Some of the main internal cues for eating include stomach contractions, that's the growling or gurgling you experience when your stomach is empty, and a physical weakness brought on by low levels of blood sugar, the major fuel used to supply your body's energy needs. These cues arise from honest-to-goodness hunger. If such cues were your only internal cues for eating, however, then you'd probably be slender and fit because you would eat only when truly hungry and stop when full. But many people who are overweight don't recognize when they are physiologically hungry and instead eat according to other types of internal cues, such as painful emotions, boredom, depression, or unchecked stress. These cues are entirely psychological rather than physiological. The desire for food comes not from your stomach, but from your head. Let's move on to talking about external cues. These are triggers that exist and operate in your environment, and they powerfully stimulate your urge to eat, whether you are physically hungry or not. Examples of external cues include sight of food, passage of time, in other words, you eat according to what the clock says, vending machines, aroma of food, flavor of food, sugary or salty foods in particular have an addictive appeal, watching television, certain locations in your house, being in your car, your office, the route you take to or from work, restaurants and drive-thrus, watching people eat, being offered food, vacations, parties, food advertisements, recipes in magazines or books. Sometimes these cues scream pretty loud, catching you completely off guard. You immediately start thinking about food and want to start eating. Every time you even think about food, your body starts reacting at a physiological level to heighten your desire to eat. You begin to salivate, for example. That is, you experience a physiological change in your mouth, and you want to eat. Scientists also believe that another reaction is triggered, one that comes about deep within your body, at the hormonal level. Suppose you're standing in front of a bakery, drooling over a banana cream pie in the window. In response to the sight of that pie, your body begins to churn out more of a hormone called insulin. Even if you don't eat a single morsel of pie, insulin begins to do a couple of its regular jobs. For one thing, it accelerates the intake of fat into the cells for storage. Yes, just looking at food may make you fat. Second, insulin reduces levels of blood sugar in your body, which it ordinarily does after you've eaten, in order to move that blood sugar into your cells for energy. This creates a state of low blood sugar that you experience as hunger. Astonishing, isn't it? Thoughts about food triggered by a cue have the power to elicit dramatic physiological reactions. If you're constantly bombarded by environmental cues, then the physiology that simultaneously occurs will work against you. Please recognize, too, that much of this bombardment comes from the food industry, which includes companies and restaurants that produce, sell, and serve food and beverages. This industry has capitalized on powerful flavor cues by developing an ever-increasing array of high-fat, sugary, salty foods with addictive appeal, and by encouraging you, through advertising, to eat more of those foods. As a result, millions of people look to the food industry to make their choices for them, from breakfast all the way to late-night snacking. As food buyers, we've yielded our power to choose. Consider the proof. If you are the average, typical American, you consume roughly 158 pounds of sugar a year in the form of pure sugar, corn sweeteners, honey, maple syrup, and other edible syrups found in soft drinks, sweets, commercially baked foods, and other processed foods. You are also eating, on average, 63 pounds of added fat a year. That's double what people ate in the early 20th century, from butter on your bread to fats and oils used in fried foods and commercially prepared cookies and pastries. If you regularly watch television, the most widely used advertising medium, you are being bombarded with messages that tell you what to eat, where to eat, when to eat, and why to eat. The most heavily advertised foods are the ones most responsible for the obesity epidemic. Fast foods, snacks, candy, prepared convenience foods, soft drinks, and alcoholic beverages. You are urged to eat them in your car, at parties, at sporting events, in restaurants, at movie theaters, practically everywhere except your dining room table. Food advertising sells you food emotionally. Have you noticed? Eat more food and it will bring more fun, happiness, belonging, even love, to the point of sometimes suggesting that food will help you attract someone of the opposite sex. The more your internally defined self-worth is lacking, the more vulnerable you are to this type of external cue. The food industry is pushing a make-eating fast agenda as well. Since 1972, the number of fast food restaurants in the United States has doubled, hawking high-fat, high-caloric, nutrition-weak foods to millions of consumers only too willing to gobble them up. Burger King alone sells 4 million Whoppers a day. Along with our waistlines, portion sizes in prepackaged ready-to-eat foods and at restaurants are getting bigger and bigger. This is in part because, as consumers, we value a greater quantity of food and drink for a lower price, a value that the food industry is more than willing to provide. You need to go on alert here that you and your family are being targeted by these billion-bucks industries. I'm calling on you to move the target, that's you, so that you cause them to miss their aim. Move the target by not buying into this stuff. If you continue to choose to let the food industry make your choices for you, then you're setting yourself up for more years of living in the same state of continual chaos. It's about you deciding whether you are going to be the bullseye for the rest of your life, waiting to get hit by the arrow. You control what you buy or don't buy. You control where you decide to eat and what you decide to eat when you get there. Like it or not, a lot of cause and effect is in your hands. The greater knowledge you have about what's going on in the world around you, the more power you have to control the outcomes in your life. Clearly, cues govern your behavior in powerful ways, which is why you have to eliminate as many of them as you reasonably can from your own environment and make choices to avoid them. When you rid your world of cues, making small but meaningful adjustments in your lifestyle, you powerfully program yourself against the possibility of additional weight gain. Programming your environment in this way will produce near automatic changes in your behavior, making it totally unnecessary to rely on willpower. Sure, willpower helps you build up a short-lived burst of energy that will lead to some temporary changes, but it's never going to be enough. When willpower fails, you'll resume your old patterns of eating and coping. Programming, on the other hand, moves you out of the repetitious rut of bad habits and gets you into the groove of permanent weight control. For example, if you always grab a handful of candy from the candy dish next to your sofa, it doesn't make sense to battle the fickle emotion of willpower in order to resist the urge to eat it. The best way to deal with that candy is to empty the dish and get rid of the stuff. You can't eat what's not there, so pretty soon your candy-eating habit will no longer have you in its clutch. Failure-proofing your environment doesn't involve any big inner struggle. All it involves is removing fattening impulse foods from your line of sight. In my own life, I've experienced how dramatically effective programming can be. I am invariably hungry when I come home at the end of the day. For the longest time, I would enter the house through a door that led me through the kitchen. I would tell myself repeatedly that I wasn't going to snack before dinner. Sometimes the emotion of willpower would carry me, sometimes it wouldn't. As I cruised through the kitchen, the environment was full of temptation, and I'd start grabbing junk foods right and left. Maybe there were cookies on a platter one day, a chocolate cake the next, or some other food I would quickly consume. It was not unusual for me to wolf down thousands of calories, go take a shower, then come back and sit down for a full dinner. Essentially, I was eating twice. To program myself for success, I just started entering the house through another door that did not take me through the kitchen. The route I took had no opportunities for failure, and I got past the habitual reactive snacking that had plagued me. Believe me, this method is a lot more pleasant and effective than having to reach down and muster up willpower. The significance of programming is that it recognizes that your life is full of temptations to overeat and opportunities to fail at weight control. But when you learn to reprogram all the wrong things you've been doing, you will discover that it is so much easier to lose weight because your life will no longer revolve around food. If you never see cookies, you will lose your cookie-eating desires, and cookies will eventually become less tempting. Further, if you replace those cookies with apples, oranges, or some other healthy snack food, a new preference is developed. Each time you choose a healthier substitute, that preference gets stronger and becomes more and more appetizing. Decreasing access and exposure to foods is a big deal. It works, and it has been scientifically verified to work. In numerous experiments, investigators have shown that a person's choice will shift from high-calorie, high-fat snack foods to healthy foods when it becomes difficult to obtain the snack foods, but easier to get fruits, vegetables, and other more nutritious snacks. This research into what investigators call choice shift acknowledges and proves some common sense wisdom. You'll eat what's available. You can't eat what's not there, and you won't eat what you don't buy. It also shows that after a period of new eating behavior, you may not desire any snack food other than foods like plump, juicy fruits or delicious, satisfying vegetables. What I'm now challenging you to do is reduce the availability of fattening foods so that your own food choices will shift to healthier, more nutritious foods. I want you to make sure that your exposure to high-calorie, high-fat junk foods and cues to eat them are greatly reduced. There is no room here for cutting corners or rationalizing the maintenance of any of these cues in your life. You are dealing with environmental influences that you set up through the choices you made. I also want to challenge you to listen to internal cues signaling true physical hunger and eat in response to those rather than to external cues. Here are the steps. Step 1. Make your environment safe. Now recall that yes-no quiz about food that I had you take a little while ago? That was your personal environment audit. What I want you to do now is to keep that audit in mind while you comb your pantry, your refrigerator, your closet, your drawers, wherever you store food, and see what you can throw away, give away, or take to the food shelter. It is certainly not unreasonable to rid your environment of any of the following: cookies, candy, and any high-calorie sweetened snack foods. Salty foods such as potato chips, pretzels, taco chips, nuts, and other packaged munchies. Sweet rolls and donuts, white bread, white rolls, white buns, crackers, cold cuts, ice cream, and high-sugar frozen desserts. Quick-fix prepared foods such as pizza, fried entrees, and microwavable sandwiches. Syrups, jams, jellies, high-fat spreads, peanut butter and dips. Sugared soft drinks and beverages. Alcoholic beverages, any food that can be classified as junk food, any food that you habitually binge on. I do believe that eventually many of you will be able to develop a healthy relationship with food and will not have to deprive yourself or be afraid of certain foods. But for the time being, toss this stuff out or at least get it out of your sight. Do this now so that it's impossible for you to fail. Begin today to reprogram your environment and set yourself up for success. Okay, I suspect that right now you're thinking, well, that sounds fine and good, but there are foods I need to keep around for my kids. They aren't fat. Why should they suffer? Trust me, I understand your concern, having experienced it in my own family. Robin and I have a very active, athletic 16-year-old son, Jordan, who, in addition to the healthy stuff we eat at our house, also likes pizza, brownies, potato chips, and all the rest. For those of you in the same boat, there are solutions if you have to keep these foods around. What we do at home, for example, is designate a special cabinet in our kitchen for Jordan's foods and snacks. That's his territory, and it's off limits to anyone but him. We don't go pecking around his food. Another way to decrease your exposure to foods you buy for your kids is to purchase these foods in smaller packages. Rather than get a jumbo sack of chips that you're likely to scarf down in one sitting, why not buy smaller single serving sizes? With this approach, you've got automatic portion control. Yes, it's costlier money-wise, but it's far less costly to your weight and to your health. But I pause here to issue a critical caveat. You do need to monitor what your child eats. The rate of childhood obesity in this country is reeling out of control. As a parent, you are the person who is the food buyer and food preparer in your family. That means you are accountable for your kids' health and well-being while they are under your care. Start setting the right example by buying healthy snacks and serving nutritious meals for your household. There are two other related concerns we need to address right away. First, are you preparing or purchasing foods that you say your kids like, but secretly, they're your favorite binge foods? Maybe you're baking peanut butter cookies because you crave them, not because they're your kids' favorite cookies. Maybe those taco chips stashed in the cupboard are for your late-night snacking and not really an after-school snack for your son or daughter. Don't con yourself here. If you feel you must keep certain foods on hand for your family, make sure that these are foods your kids or spouse really like, not foods you want. I'm calling your attention to this because self-honesty is absolutely fundamental to managing and programming your environment for success. You can con yourself in another way, too, by telling yourself that if you get rid of all the goodies that your kids like, they will think you don't love them anymore. Well, just hold on. Let's take an intermission to examine the faulty logic at work here. You believe you are loving your children with food when, in fact, you are poisoning them with too much junk food that someday will make them physically sick and obese? Feeding your family with nutritionally weak food is toxic in its eventual outcome. How dumb is that? Look at it this way. The sooner you interrupt your family's habit of eating junk food, the easier it will be to establish new, healthier, more productive behaviors in their lives. That is an incredible display of love. Step 2. Begin the process of choice shift. This step is simple and straightforward. More common sense than anything else. It stands to reason that as you remove junk foods from your environment or place them out of sight, you must replace them with better foods so that your food choices will naturally and eventually shift to healthier alternatives. Begin to stock your kitchen with fruits, vegetables, whole grains, lean meats, low-fat milk products, milk, yogurt, hard and soft cheeses, etc., low-fat or fat-free foods and snacks. Sugar-free beverages. Remember, your taste preferences will shift to healthier, more nourishing foods if you give yourself every chance to break from the old and come in with the new. Step 3. Practice smart shopping. This step addresses one of the most temptation-rich environments you will ever encounter, the grocery store, where there are more than 50,000 food items, all packaged attractively and positioned strategically on the shelves to get you to buy them. Step 3 helps brace you against their allure so that you can exert an astonishing level of control in this environment. Make it a point to shop from a grocery list prepared when you're not hungry or stressed out. Determine exactly what you need for a particular period of time and don't overbuy. Stick to the outer aisles where the fresh, additive-free foods are located. Never go grocery shopping when you're hungry. The entire store, from the food aisles to the checkout line, can tempt you to buy foods that you neither want nor need. Assign someone else in your family the job of grocery shopping on occasion in order to limit your exposure to food. Step 4. Make changes away from home. As a part of failure-proofing your environment, you must have particular plans in place for handling what could be some of the weakest spots in your efforts, such as eating out, eating away from home, or eating too much while on vacation. For many of you, eating away from home, at restaurants, parties, or on vacations, is problematic. The key is to take some time to pre-plan for those situations and identify those things that could and should be the focus of your management efforts. When you're dining out, for example, choose a restaurant that offers a variety of foods so that you can choose healthier menu items. When you get there, be assertive with the waitstaff. Tell your server you want your food prepared without fats, oils, or sauces. At parties, get in the habit of passing up the fattening food and opting for healthier choices instead. Choose smaller portions and ask for a diet soda or club soda in lieu of an alcoholic drink. Stand away from the food and focus instead on people and conversations. Vacations can be difficult, but try to exert the same control in your choice-making that you would do at home. If you're flying, you don't have to settle for the typical airline food. Simply call the airline ahead of time and request a low-calorie meal. You can do this practically anywhere, even on cruises, as long as you give the food preparation personnel plenty of notice. Compensate for eating calorie-dense foods by staying active while you're on vacation. If the circumstances are such that you simply cannot control your choices, take it easy and eat smaller portions. Bottom line, there's no good reason for you to experience any backsliding when you have a strategy in place to handle it. When these situations arise, as you know they will, you won't panic and start eating everything in sight. You will simply say to yourself, "This is the very thing I knew would happen, and I know how to deal with it. I won't panic. I won't give in because I'm encountering normal challenges of day-to-day life. I am in control."